It's to the best of our knowledge.
What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?
That was an excerpt of Langston Hughes reading his poem, Harlem, A Dream Deferred. So, what does happen to dreams deferred? Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, join us for a variety of views and opinions from Black Americans on their expectations of freedom. First, the news. From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
This nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free.
That's President John F. Kennedy, referring to Black America in 1963. Now, more than 40 years later, in a post-civil rights era, the question has to be asked, are Black Americans truly free? To get at that question, we decided this hour to look at the expectations of freedom for Black Americans.
I expect for Black freedom to surprise the hell out of absolutely everybody by what is going to happen and what's not going to happen, and especially by who's going to be left by the wayside.
The leaders of the civil rights movement not only demanded equal rights for Black America, they expected it. One of those leaders was named Bayard Rustin. Historian John DeMillo is the author of the book called Lost Prophet, The Life and Times of Bayard Rustin. DeMillo says Rustin was a pivotal figure in the civil rights movement, but he's been virtually erased by history.
He's incredibly important in terms of the movements for peace and social justice in post-World War II America. More than anybody else, he's the one who brings Gandhi and Gandhian ideas to the Black civil rights struggle, things that we normally associate with Martin Luther King. He mentors Martin Luther King. But yet, whereas Martin Luther King is a name that every person alive in the United States knows, no one knows who Bayard Rustin is except hardcore pacifists and aficionados of the civil rights movement. And the reason for that is that Rustin had to figure out how to be an agitator for justice and work effectively without people noticing him because he was a gay man living in an era when the constraints on that were so intense.
To make things unworkable. The only weapon we have is our bodies, and we need to tuck them in places so wheels don't turn.
Rustin grew up in southeastern Pennsylvania in really Quaker country, and his grandmother, who was the key person in his life, had worked in Quaker households, and so Quakerism was part of his environment. And by the time he was in his mid-20s, he actually began going to Quaker meetings very regularly. It suffused the way he looked at the world. There was a personal pacifism as well as a political pacifism that shaped his outlook. And when World War II came along, you know, most other Americans thought of it as a war that was eminently justified, and Bayard Rustin chose to go to jail rather than in any way cooperate with the military.
I am a Quaker, and as everyone knows, Quakers for 300 years have, on conscientious grounds, been against participating in war.
Rustin often said that King was one of the most impressive figures he had ever met. that King had a power that Byard had rarely encountered in another human. At the same time, it was a charismatic power that lacked the skills of community organizing, of knowing how to build a movement, how to create an organization, how to have a strategy of change as opposed to simply saying, march, people. And Rustin was the one who taught him about strategy and about organization and about movement building, and who acted as his point man in doing those sorts of things. And that's what Rustin brought to King when Rustin was in his mid-40s and King was still a very young minister in his mid-20s.
There are three ways to deal with injustice. One is to accept it slavishly, or one can resist it with arms, or one can use nonviolence. The man who believes in nonviolence is prepared to be harmed, to be crushed, but he will never crush others.
For a number of years, King just turned to Rustin. He would say, write me this article and I'll sign it. Or, yes, I'll meet with these people who can fundraise. Or, yes, this, yes, that, yes, the other thing. And for years, he didn't make an important decision without consulting Rustin. And Rustin made himself available. But Rustin always used to say that while King was very good at confronting, quote, the enemy, the segregationist, he was not very good at confronting turmoil within the ranks of the civil rights movement. So that when controversy would surround Rustin, when people would bring up at times his either radical background or his gayness, Martin Luther King would cave. And there was this one critical moment in 1960 where Adam Clayton Powell, who was a congressman from Harlem, the most prominent African American in national politics in the Democratic Party, was getting a little teed off, really, at Rustin's effort to exert influence, and especially in relationship to the Democratic Party. And Powell lets King know that if he doesn't get rid of Rustin as his assistant, Powell is going to start spreading rumors that King and Rustin are sexually involved. Well, King caved in, and here they had this really close relationship for like 5 years and then barely spoke to each other for another 2 years or 2.5 years.
I must walk my lonesome valley. I got to walk it for myself. Nobody else can walk it for me. I gotta walk it for myself.
Strom Thurmond, who was, you know, he had run as a segregationist for president in 1948. In 1963, he is prepared to do anything to discredit the civil rights movement. And the March on Washington was the big upcoming event. He tried to discredit it by saying, oh, it's a bunch of communists who are doing it, and people yawned. And he then moved on to isolating Rustin, who at that point was known as really Mr. March on Washington. And he gets up on the Senate floor and reads into the congressional record Rustin's arrest record, reads from newspaper clippings in the Los Angeles papers from the 1950s about Rustin getting arrested.
The senator is not interested in me if I were a murderer, a thief, a liar, or a pervert. The senator is interested in attacking me because he is interested in destroying the movement. He will not get away with this.
We're marching on to freedom land. We're marching on to freedom land.
It becomes actually a turning point in Rustin's public career because the march was only like maybe 2 weeks away at that point, and it was too big an event. And so the civil rights establishment has to, for the first time, publicly defend Rustin because the alternative is to cave into Strom Thurmond, arch enemy of the community and the movement. And so it's the point at which the gay card is finally trumped in Rustin's life. It's now so public, and the movement has said, we don't care.
I now bring to you the executive director of the March on Washington, the man who organized this whole thing, Mr. Byard Rustin.
Ladies and gentlemen, demand is that we have effective civil rights legislation, no compromise, no filibuster, and that it includes public accommodations, decent housing, integrated education, FAPC, and the right to vote. What do you say?
The thing to me that's so amazing about his life is that he comes from nowhere. You know, he's the illegitimate son of a teenage mother in a small provincial town, right? And he travels the globe. He organizes demonstrations on four continents. He moves among people who really do make history. Rustin is not a tragic figure. He rises from the ashes again and again. And especially if you look at pictures of him late in life, this guy was having a lot of fun. I mean, he had a good life. What is tragic for us as a nation, really, or as a people, is that the talents of this man could not be fully utilized in the way that they could have the biggest impact on history. The tragedy is the homophobia and the racism. But Rustin, you have to say, I mean, the guy never gave up.
John DeMillo is the author of the book called Lost Prophet, The Life and Times of Bayard Rustin. Rustin remained committed to racial equality and world peace until his death in 1987.
From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state, and every we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last.
That's the Noise Conspiracy's remix of Martin Luther King's Let Freedom Ring speech from the 1963 March on Washington. Another great leader of the civil rights movement is Stokely Carmichael. Though head of the powerful Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, Carmichael's best known for coining the phrase Black Power. Here's Stokely Carmichael in June of 1966.
We need black power in this country so that when a bunch of white state troopers stand up and shoot us down with gas, that we can't kneel and pray any longer. We need power to stop it. We've got to have black power.
That's Stokely Carmichael uttering the infamous phrase, black power. Michael Thelwell was a lifelong friend of Stokely Carmichael and a fellow activist. When Stokely Carmichael was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 1996, he asked Thelwell to collaborate with him on his autobiography. It's called Ready for Revolution. It was published some 5 years after Stokely Carmichael's death. Steve Paulson spoke with Michael Thelwell about the life and legacy of Stokely Carmichael.
Can you tell me about the first time he talked publicly about black power?
With black power, what he was in fact articulating was a series of attitudes, aspirations, and feelings which had been percolating up from the very grassroots of the community, but had never gotten public articulation. So when Carmichael started to articulate it, the response was remarkable across the length and breadth of the black community, and across, indeed, as would turn out later, across the black world.
Why? Why was there such a strong response to those words, black power?
Well, because you have to understand the context in which we came up as young black people, as people involved in the civil rights movement. There was a formula that what you had to do was, what black people had to do, what the nature of the struggle was that black people should make themselves acceptable to white folk, to make themselves worthy of integration and acceptance in American society. And what black power said was very simply, no, we don't have to make ourselves acceptable to you. the society has to accommodate itself to who we are. Or what we are has value, what we are has integrity, and we're not going to change to get acceptance in white America. That's what accounts for the response to it. 1968 was the first time I heard Stokely speak publicly on it. And when Carmichael began to speak, the response of the audience was palpable. It was intense. It was visceral. And to my incredible surprise, here my young friend and brother is speaking, and I find myself on my feet shouting with tears in my eyes. And what he was articulating spoke so clearly to my own perceptions and my own feelings. I was very surprised at that response.
And that for me to beg to get into that community is for me to dehumanize myself. And I shall not do that. I am a human being. I am black. I am equal. This country is racist from top to bottom, from right to left.
Right!
And for black people to become a part of that is for them to become, in fact, anti-black and to hate themselves.
One way that this whole controversy over Stokely Carmichael's use of black power played out was that it seemed to signal a rift between Stokely Carmichael, a sort of a more radical element within the civil rights movement, and Martin Luther King.
That is purely a media conclusion. The relationship between Dr. King and Stokely was always a very warm, very fraternal, very respectful one. And Dr. King never attacked Black Power. He thought the language might be unfortunate. And he said publicly it might excite certain anxieties in white listeners. But as Carmichael would say to him, you know, you're the very exemplar of Black Power. You run a black organization. How many white sopranos are there in the choir at the Ebenezer Church? How many white deacons are there in Ebenezer? So Dr. King understood the term. He just thought it might not be politically the most expedient term to be using.
Did Stokely Carmichael become more radicalized as the 60s progressed?
You know, that depends on your perspective. In terms of the media, in terms of mainstream white America, in terms of what we used to call the totalitarian liberals, Carmichael became more radicalized. The civil rights movement became more radicalized. White American youth became more radicalized. Well, what does radicalized mean? Because Carmichael would argue, and I would agree with him, that the positions one took were logical in the context. And not only logical in the context, but moral positions, principled positions, which were in accordance with the promises of the American social contract and the language of American self-definition, democracy, justice, equality, freedom. As Jimmy Baldwin pointed out, you know, it was curious how the older American generation listened to their children using the language and the rhetoric of their own self-description as though they were totally alien, revolutionary, and fearsome concepts.
Now let us explain how the process of exploitation and colonization works. If I am black and I am exploiting you who are also black, we have the same values, the same culture, the same language, the same society, the same institutions. So I do not have to destroy those institutions for you. But if you are of another race, if you have a different culture, different language, different values, I have to destroy all of those to make you bow to me. And that is the difference between poor black and poor white. Poor whites have their culture, have their values, have their institutions. Ours have been completely destroyed. Completely destroyed. Completely destroyed.
He always considered himself a revolutionary. What did that mean to him?
Well, it means, on the most simple level, what the term revolution means. A radical overthrow, turning over of the lines of government and control of a society. But that was only, again, the superficial meaning, and that's the meaning that the media focused on. But Carmichael was talking about a revolution in consciousness, and he thought that only the people could bring this about. He didn't believe in vanguard parties. He didn't believe in inspired revolutionary leaders acting to generate social change. He says, no one man can free the people.
Do you think Stokely Carmichael today is much of a presence in black America? And I'm wondering particularly about the younger generation, say the, you know, the hip-hop artists who have constantly invoked Malcolm X, for instance. Mm-hmm. Is Stokely Carmichael a presence, a formidable figure for this generation?
Well, it's not a formidable figure in that sense. But, you know, was it Balzac who said about the novelist in his novel, his hand should be everywhere, but his presence never seen? You know, a lot of young people wouldn't recognize the name. But in point of fact, you see the effects and consequences of what Carmichael represented and struggled for throughout the community. It all begun with Black Power, with the Black Power movement.
Michael Thelwell is professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts. Thelwell was a lifelong friend and comrade of Stokely Carmichael and collaborated with him on his autobiography, Ready for Revolution. Here's Stokely Carmichael speaking at a rally in support of Black Panther Huey Newton in Oakland, California, in 1968.
Now then, we have to understand more and more as our people this talk about survival. It means that when we talk about survival, we organize politically, we organize consciously, we organize economically, and we organize militarily. Militarily. Because if we don't do that, if you don't have a gun in your hand, they can snatch the ballot from you. But if you got a gun, it's either them or us. And unless we raise our minds to the level of consciousness where we have an undying love for our people, where we're willing to shed our blood like Huey Newton did for our people, we will not survive. We will not survive.
Stokely Carmichael speaking at a rally in support of Black Panther Huey Newton in 1968. Soon after, Carmichael moved to Africa and changed his name to Kwame Ture. He died in Guinea in 1998. Coming up, more on the expectations of black freedom as our discussion continues. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
We've been documenting African-American artists in the South for 20 or 30 years, and one of them told me many years ago that when he was a little boy in the second grade or so, the teacher was asking each of the children what they wanted to be when they grew up. And he said, well, I want to make art. And the teacher said, art's for white people. This was an African-American teacher in an African-American classroom. African-American children were not encouraged to make things that were creative, so they didn't grow up thinking, I'm going to be an artist, I'm going to make art. However, they did it anyway.
Mason Jada, my Lord said, come on in, I'll meet you there.
This is a story about a place where people did make art, despite all the obstacles put in their way. G's Bend, Alabama, a place that's become a modern legend. It's a Cinderella story with a bunch of elderly African-American quilters as heroines. It's a story about women who had no money and no opportunities, whose spirits were so rich and whose vision was so great that they took the scraps they had and created an art today that hangs in the nation's finest museums. And Strange Hems has more.
The first time I saw G's Bend quilt, it hit me like a punch in the gut. I've loved quilts all my life. One of my earliest baby pictures shows me lying naked on a double wedding ring quilt that my great-grandmother made. The G's Bend quilts are not like anything I've ever seen before. They're made of worn denim and corduroy, old sheets and flannel shirts. The stitching is uneven. The patterns are huge and irregular, like large-scale geometries and big color fields. They look kind of like what an abstract painter like Paul Klee or Frank Stella might have made if you knew how to hold a needle. My great-grandmother's quilt is very pretty. The G's Bend quilts are something a whole lot stronger than pretty. like the women who made them.
We didn't have nothing. What little we had, we took it and made it. We weren't blessed with cars and all these washing machines and things, but people were smart. They worked it together. They helped one another. They shared with one another. We worked for the white people and made them rich and left us poor.
If one has not been there, one cannot imagine how isolated it really is. It's at the end of a long road, and almost nobody goes there, and there are only a few hundred residents scattered about. It's not like a town. It's just an isolated little group of houses and people. And most of them over the years have made quilts that are now recognized as being among most important works of art in American history.
That's Bill Arnett. He's a collector who spent 30 years researching and documenting African-American artists. Now, 6 years ago, he ran across a photograph of quilt maker Annie Mae Young. She was standing in front of a quilt draped over a wood pile in her yard.
The quilt was so good, it wasn't just a quilt. I mean, I had collected a number of quilts over the years, and I would go sometimes fairly great distances to meet a quilt maker if I thought quilt maker was in some ways remarkable, but this was a quilt that I had never seen the likes of.
What did it look like?
It was a quilt made out of denim work clothes and corduroy. It was blue and orange and yellow. It was just quite a remarkable quilt, and unlike anything I had ever seen. Haven't even seen anything since.
When Arnett found Annie Mae Young, she introduced him to her friends, and it turned out in this one tiny, isolated community, there were hundreds of quilt masterpieces stashed away in closets and stuffed under beds. There were quilts going back 3 and 4 generations, and all with these powerful, original designs. Now, one thing I've puzzled over is, what makes the G's Bend quilts so fascinating, so compelling to the people who see them? And partly I think it's that there's something confounding about them. I mean, how did women who'd never seen or even heard of modern abstract art make quilts that embody its principles? How could women who lived such impoverished lives develop such a rich artistic vision? I guess that's the mysteriousness of all original art. No one can tell you where it comes from, not even the artist.
Well, I started making quilts. I was young. Exactly how old I was, but I was young when I started making quilts. When I started, I didn't even know how to make a quilt, you know, too good. I just got some pieces, sewed them together. Piecing all these fancy quilts. Just do my way, you know.
See, my mom tell me, come on, Lonzo, and help me get these pants legs and things straight and cut them out for me. And I would sit there and rip them loose, you know, and cut the good part off. Because in those days, you weren't able to go to the store and buy just quilt patterns, something to make quilts out. You just had to get dress tails and skirt tails and pant legs and shirt sleeves to make quilts out.
Oh, please.
When I come home, I do my chores. I wash. I clean yard. I mop. I cook. I kept my kids clean, I fixed their clothes, I ironed their clothes, and then I would go to quilting, and I would quilt then until about 2 or 3 o'clock in the night.
The quilts that Bill Arnett bought for as little as $40 a piece now sell in the 5 figures, and the prices are still going up. If you can't afford an original, Anthropology is bringing out a line of reproductions. It's also ironic. A few years ago, a quilting cooperative in a nearby town refused to hire Annie Mae Young. They said her stitching wasn't good enough. Now there's a whole section of her quilts in the G's Bend Museum show. Of course, anything that brings money to the people of G's Bend has to be a good thing. It makes me feel a little uncomfortable seeing the quilts commercialized, like maybe this is just a new chapter in the old story of the white romanticization of the so-called primitive. It was white culture that kept places like G's Bend down. And so now there will be a bunch of affluent white people with G's Bend quilts hanging on their walls. Maybe that's a good thing.
It's a good thing to think that I did some work that somebody thought it was good enough to put on a wall. They were just something I just was doing to get those clothes about the house and get rid of some of the stuff that the children wasn't wearing anymore. It wasn't good enough to give to anybody to wear, so I just thought it was okay to put it in a quilt. and it can go on a bed and keep somebody warm and comfortable.
Like my great-grandmother's quilt. It's the only thing I have of hers. It's all I know about her. She lived and died before I was even born, but her DNA flows in my veins. And when I curl up under her quilt, I'm surrounded by the love and caring she stitched into our family, piece by piece.
The Quilts of G's Bend exhibition opens in June at the Cleveland Museum of Art. We heard the voices of Annie Mae Young, Arlanzia Petway, Loretta Petway, and Essie Bendolf Petway from the documentary that accompanies the exhibit, and Strange Champs produced the piece. Coming up, one black writer asks, does racism work for you? And she's not talking to white people.
I think many of the most militant black people are the ones who are hiding in racism so that they don't have to face themselves.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
President John Kennedy in 1963.
This afternoon, following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happen to have been born Negro.
President Kennedy, addressing the nation on a day that changed American politics. Let me set the scene. The time was June 11, 1963. The place, the University of Alabama. The protagonists are now infamous. President John Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy on one side. On the other, the symbol of racism, Alabama Governor George Wallace. A federal judge had ordered the university to integrate, and Wallace publicly vowed segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Wallace announced he would personally, physically block any blacks attempting to enroll at the school. With National Guard troops and state troopers massed, the line in the sand had been drawn. Caught in the middle were the two black teenagers looking to attend the University of Alabama, Vivian Malone and James Hood. I recently visited with James Hood at our studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Hood has a surprising take on those historic events. So how does he remember that day?
I had not envisioned this guy standing there. I figured that perhaps he would back away and decide that it was not worth whatever the effort was that he had put into it. I did not realize the political significance that it had to him as an individual and being governor as well. So that never came to fruition until the night before when I saw them go on television and he said he was going to be there. And then I realized, he's not going to back away. And so that became perhaps more realistic the night before than it had up until that point, because I had felt that he was probably doing it to make a big show, and that when the push came to shove, he was going to back away.
That morning, you and Vivian were brought to the hall where you were to go in.
Correct.
In fact, we have audio of what George Wallace said.
The unwelcomed, unwanted, unwarranted, and force-induced intrusion upon the campus of the University of Alabama, the day of the might of the central government, offers frightful example of the oppression of the rights, privileges, and sovereignty of this state by officers of the federal government. While some few may applaud these acts, millions of Americans will gaze in sorrow upon the situation existing at this great institution of learning.
Were you disappointed when you saw him standing there actually ready to block your entrance?
No. And let me tell you why, because there's part of this that people don't know. We were already registered. We had registered in the federal court 2 days before we went to the university. So it didn't matter whether he stood there or not. We were going to school. That was understood. So in a sense, it was his opportunity to do what he had promised, and that was to stand in the doorway. Now, the question was he going to acquiesce and walk away? and accept the court order, or was he going to stand there and defy it? That was the only issue.
Well, you didn't go through the door right then. You went off to your dormitory rooms wait for a while until the president nationalized the Alabama National Guard.
Correct.
To make it possible for you to go in later in the day.
Correct.
Who was the commander of the National Guard?
General Graham.
General Graham.
Right.
Tell me about him.
Okay. Prior to going back that afternoon, I had a chance to meet General Graham because he came over to the dormitory to tell me what he was going to do and how it was going to take place. I kept saying, well, what happens if he doesn't move and this guy has to manhandle him? Yeah. Well, General Graham assured me that he would do whatever he needed to do, that he was going to take him down, and that was his word. I will take him down if I need to.
And, in fact, there was no problem.
No. As a matter of fact, when he confronted the governor with the order from the president that he was now in charge of the guard and that it was his duty to carry out the orders of the president as well as the order of the court, then there was nothing left. I mean, the governor could choose to ignore the order, the federal order, or he could choose to confront the military, which was going to enforce the order. So it was, you know, it was a catch-22 in a sense.
Yeah.
There was no win for the governor at that point.
What about George Wallace? I understand later, after he was shot, he was paralyzed, he apologized.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I went back to the university to get my doctorate in 1985. So I arranged on July 5th of 1996 to go visit with him. And I had two things that I wanted to talk to him about in private. First was, why did he stand in the doorway? Because I wanted to hear him tell me what his reasons were, and I needed to know for myself, because Vivian felt it was racial. I never felt that. I felt it was something other than that. And so I wanted to ask him, because he's the only person who could answer that. And then the second thing I wanted to do was to invite him to my graduation, because I was convinced that I was going to finish up my doctorate, and I wanted him there. And that's exactly what happened. I had a chance to spend about an hour with him in private talking about various things and to ask him the question and to invite him, and he agreed that he was going to come. And then when he told me what the reason was why he stood in the doorway, then that simply satisfied what my curiosity over 34 years. I had never heard him explain what the specific reason were, at least to my satisfaction.
Can you share that?
Yes. He said that it was not about black or white. It was about states' rights. And that was one of his major things, that the federal government had no right to tell the governor of a state how to implement educational process. And when I pointed out that there's a conflict between what you're saying to me versus what the Constitution guarantees me, and his point was, it's a moral issue. It was a moral issue.
Moral issue. It comes from your heart in the first place. If I thought it was sinful and irreligious and immoral to separate myself socially and educationally from Negro citizens, then I would commit a sin when I did so, I suppose. I believe that separation is good for the Negro citizen and the white citizen.
Was it up to that point a moral issue for you, the question of integration?
Yes. And I never really saw Governor Wallace's standing in the doorway as a black and white issue, even though that's how it had been contextualized by many people. Because if I wanted to go and I had a right to go, then my sister, if she chose to go, or my brothers, if they chose to go, had the same right to do it. So in a sense, it became an issue of the rightness of it as opposed to the legality of it. And that's how I looked at it.
Ironically, President Kennedy, like Governor Wallace, saw integration as a moral issue. Here's how the president couched the day's events just hours after they unfolded.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated.
When you went back to the University of Alabama in 1995 to get your PhD, you went back to a campus with over 20,000 black students. What was that like?
One of the things that shocked and made me somewhat uncomfortable was the fact that students chose to segregate themselves. I mean, I'd go to the dining hall, for example, and black students would be in one little corner, white students would be in another corner, Japanese students would be in another corner. And to me, that was defeating the whole purpose for which we went there, in a sense, if you're looking at the grand picture, and that was to integrate the campus so that people could sit and talk and fellowship together and have a relationship. It isn't that way. And to me, still, it's a segregated campus, not because of law, but because of choice. Hmm. And that, to me, was frustrating.
James Hood is the retired dean of the Madison Area Technical College. Hood's memoir, called Goodbye, George, will soon be published. Here's more of President Kennedy's address to the nation, the night of the events of June 11, 1963.
I hope that every American, regardless of where he lives, will stop and examine his conscience about this and other related incidents. This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet free from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free.
It's President Kennedy speaking over 40 years ago. Unfortunately, in many ways, his words still ring true. Despite the gains of the civil rights movement, systematic racism still exists. Deborah Dickerson couldn't agree more. As a black woman in America, she knows firsthand the effects of racism. But don't pigeonhole her response to it. Dickerson's new book is provocatively titled The End of Blackness. It's proven, well, controversial in the black community, to say the least. Steve Paulson wanted to know more.
The back cover of your book has five words on it. Does racism work for you? Who is that question for?
That's a really good question, and so few people get it. I think the assumption is that I meant it for white people, but I mean it for black people. Have you, in a sly way that you don't admit to anyone, including yourself, have you made your peace with racism in a post-movement environment? Because racism doesn't have the same effects now that it had before the movement. Have you made your peace with it? And in fact, have you made it work for you in your own life? Does it relieve you of the responsibility to be the best human being that you could be?
So you're saying that the problem for a lot of black people is that they blame their problems on racism and then they don't do certain things that they could do to get their lives together.
I think it's deeper than that. I think a lot of us hide in racism. We hide from ourselves in there. I think where many of us, the people who this question is the most difficult for, the ones that it makes the most angry, are the ones, I think, who are secretly afraid at the core of their being that the lies are true, that we really are stupid, we really are ugly, and we really are more prone to violence and criminality, and we really are lazy. So I think many of the most militant black people are the ones who are hiding in racism so that they don't have to face themselves.
You write in your book that the last plantation is the mind. And it's a provocative thing to say. I mean, because one thing that you seem to be suggesting is that entrenched systemic racism no longer exists.
The analogy that I love the best is the one of Harry Houdini, who struggled to open a locked jail cell door forever. And he leaned against it in exhaustion, and it came open. In all the hubbub, they had forgotten to actually lock the lock. He never tried just opening the door and walking through it. And I think that's the perfect metaphor for blackness. I hear black people say things all the time, like a relative said she didn't want her daughter, who was being inundated with scholarship offers to Columbia and Princeton, places like that. And this is an inner city single ghetto mom, and she didn't want her daughter going to places like that because she didn't want her to lose her identity. Now, what possible sense could that make? What is her identity based on if she could lose it by going to Princeton? So it's not about militancy, and it's not about embracing our black identity. It's about being afraid to stray from these carved out pathways of what black people are and do. And it's about fear. It's about trying something and failing and finding out that the lies really aren't lies, that they're actually true. Why do we work so hard to integrate places like Princeton if it's wrong for us to actually go there now? So this is all taking place in the mind. These are all these mental constraints and mazes and pathways that fall back on themselves because we're afraid to follow these things through to their logical conclusions and their moral conclusions.
What you're saying is
is not at all what we tend to hear from civil rights leaders today, from sort of from the black leaders that we all know in America. In fact, I'm assuming they would be rather critical of what you're saying.
Would be? Google me. Everything but a child to God. You should read my Amazon.com page. Personal ad hominem attacks on my sanity and on this white husband of mine that they assume to be some loser who I'm supporting. The hysteria is there, the absolute existential terror, because it can't be physical. They can't be physically afraid of me. It's existential terror.
Well, I'm guessing, I mean, the criticism, I presume, is that you've become a stooge for the white man. I mean, you're the kind of person who will end up on Bill O'Reilly's show and sort of supporting the conservative cause, the critique of affirmative action and all kinds of other things that that conservatives hate.
I did do Bill O'Reilly, and I did critique gangster rap music. And let me tell you the reason I actually decided to write this book. I went with my mother to take my nephew, who was about 10 at the time, this would have been about 97, 98, for an organizational meeting for a diocesan basketball team that they were starting at their black Catholic church in a black inner city neighborhood. The only white people in this church were the priest and a couple of nuns. So we're signing him up for this basketball team, and the kids are eating pizza and drinking Coke. And the adults are signing up for things, escort duty and stuff. And this black lay minister, who is about 55, gets up and out of the blue starts talking to these kids. And this is what he says to them. He says, "You're going to be playing all these white churches and they're going to cheat you. And they're going to call fouls on you that are not fouls. And they're going to give points to the other team." And he just went on and on and on. "They're probably going to throw things at the bus. They're probably going to mess with your stuff in the locker room." And this man just dripped bitterness and defeatism and hatred. And so these kids were just sort of mesmerized by it. I mean, what does it take to get kids to stop eating pizza and drinking Coke? Well, this guy figured it out. And I thought, well, he's going to bring this back around. He's going to say, okay, so people may treat you badly, but that's okay. You bring it to me and we will take care of any problems you have. You focus on you. You're going to learn how to play on a team. You're going to learn how to represent your neighborhood and your church. And you're going to be good sportsmen. And you're going to learn the rules backwards and forwards. And you're going to politely ask the referee why he did this or that. But what he ended with these kids was he didn't say any of that. What he said was, so you're probably going to lose most of your games, but that's okay. And that's the moment when I said, there has got to be another way to be black. I am so tired of being black in this way that first of all requires me to sit here and not speak up in the face of this kind of evil. But just to think of myself this way, to send our black children out into the world looking at things through this ridiculous funhouse mirror.
Couldn't you make the case that, yes, he vastly overstated the case, but there's an element of truth in what he's saying, that often when you go out into the mainstream world, what is for the most part the white world, that a lot of black people do have one strike against them.
And I would say it's a huge strike. I have all the same stories that every other black person has about racism. I could fill up a whole interview with nothing but those. I'm not saying racism doesn't exist. And I'm not saying that it doesn't substantially affect people's lives. The conversation too often ends at that. White people racism. And we spend all of our time cataloging it and sort of massaging it and nursing it. But what is our response to it?
What do you make of black people who want to establish their own distinctive cultural traditions? And I'm thinking, for instance, of Kwanzaa, the sort of the alternative to Christmas, this tradition that particularly harkens back to Africa. Does that kind of thing work for you?
No. The problem I have with this whole mythology about Africa is that it seems to me a rejection of our American experience and not an embrace of anything that lives and breathes. Kwanzaa erases the Jim Crow and slave ancestors from which we come, and that I cannot do.
And that's part of the point, I think, of Kwanzaa for those people who have embraced it is, I mean, they don't want to look back on the whole Jim Crow history. I mean, they want to get away from that. That's precisely.
But that makes a mockery. That makes a mockery of the slave's perseverance. And this is something that I had to grapple with so long. To me, it was about self-hatred and shame and internalized contempt for the people who persevered to bring me here. My mother, who's 77 years old, Jim Crow sharecropper with no education. She went to maybe the 7th or 8th grade in the one-room schoolhouse in the middle of the cotton fields that they could only go to when it rained, so they couldn't work. No education, you know, washerwoman, nanny. nanny, cook, cleaning lady, the whole thing. I will not be ashamed of her. I will not. The fact that she held on and lived a life of nobility and self-sacrifice and concern for her humanity as well as others, I will not turn my back on that. And the shame I felt when my, you know, mother would come to my integrated, gifted, mostly white school and say, show enough and might have would, I could smack myself for the shame and the way that I didn't want my white friends to come to the house and hear my, you know, great-grandfather, who was the son of slaves, in his almost unintelligible Mississippi dialect. I will not turn my back on that. They did not hold on so that we could erase them in favor of these ancestors with whom, frankly, we have a very, these are the people who sold us. Why am I embracing that?
One thing I want to ask you about is something that you say in your introduction. You talk a fair amount about Black surrender. And surrender, obviously, is a very powerful word. And you even write, and I'm quoting here, Blacks must surrender themselves to America. Why not? Their enslaved ancestors did.
Yes. Yes, it's quite a notion. And that's a notion that was one of the hardest for me to accept personally. And it's still painful. It's still painful for me to read. I had to get over this notion, and I think the Black community has to get over this notion that there's some amount of evidence that's going to conclusively prove to white people that they're racist and that they're affecting us in this way, and that white people are going to come together somehow and say, oh man, you guys were right. We really are awful people. Never going to happen. Even if it did happen, so what? If all white people send us this giant Hallmark card said, you're right, we're sorry, sorry we oppressed you, it's not going to make us feel any better. We've got to surrender this notion that we can be made whole by white people.
The theme of this show that we've been talking about this hour is expectations of Black freedom. What are your expectations?
My expectations are that I expect for there to be this inward focus where many, many, many of us are going to be going back to the community, either just on an activist basis or to actually live there and focus on ourselves, because Black people hate Black people as much as anybody else does. And that's the dirty little secret that nobody wants to talk about. None of us thinks we're the nigger, but we think the next guy is. This Black guy over here is the problem, with her five kids by six different men. This one with her white husband, she's the problem. There's so much anger, internal anger against itself in the Black community, that I expect for there over the next generation to be a huge internal focus and fight over the soul of the Black community to take place. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a very good thing.
Deborah Dickerson is the author of the book called The End of Blackness. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Expectations of Black Freedom, program number 523A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.